So, guys, I want to start today's episode off with some women slander.
Oh my God, yes.
My partner not only wanted me to go to a fucking kid's birthday party. I mean, I kind of like the guy whose kid it is. A kid's birthday party.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for clarifying.
So, quite literally...
Are you related to said child?
No.
Okay.
Neither is she. And she forced me to go through this. But it wasn't just as bad as that. She forced me to wake up with a semi-hangover on Saturday because the birthday for some reason was starting at 12. Why don't children just stay up later? God fucking damn it. But no, jokes aside. And she forced me to wake up and drive halfway across the city because these parents are fucking wild barbarians that are making a birthday party in the furthest corner of the town that they don't even live in. And it's not even cheap. Like, makes no sense, but whatever. After 1 hour worth of
traffic. They didn't inconvenience you.
Yeah, 1 hour worth of traffic, 30 minutes worth of shower, 20 minutes worth of dressing up that she forced me to re-put on some clothes because, you know.
2 hours worth of
presentable
gooning.
Presentable in front of the kid. Yeah, probably 10, 15 minutes worth of gooning. We arrive there. We open the door. We walk in. And it's filled with people we've never seen in our lives.
Oh my God.
The lady there is like, oh, hi. You might not be at the proper place, like the mother of the kid that is celebrating their birthday there. And the kid is a boy. And we're going to a first birthday party of a girl. And I'm looking at my girlfriend. I'm like, are you sure we're at the right fucking spot? As we walk out, she starts laughing and she says, it's tomorrow.
Oh.
So the whole next day, I had to redo all of that and then spend 4 hours at a fucking kid's birthday party. I am sorry, people suffering in war zones all over the world, but my shit was almost at that level.
Was it lit? The proper party?
I felt like the guy put me next to his brother. His brother's like 35 years old. He's very cool.
Oh,
and they didn't have alcohol in the whole thing. And he brought for us like a bottle of vodka. And he's like, because we were also the only two that are not dads in that whole place. Mm. And they were like, guys, please drink for me because I cannot. Mm. And he went to babysit kids and was slowly losing his fucking mind. But no, it was okay. It was okay. I caught up with people from the other side of the country that I don't see regularly and listen to quite a lot of demonic sounding children. But other than that, it was fine. It was just double the effort. Double the effort. Yeah, of course I had cake.
What cake was it?
I don't know, like strawberry Nutella thing, like strawberry chocolate.
But it was like a kid's dedicated thing. It wasn't like they didn't go all out for this fucking cake.
No. I mean, it was the first birthday, so they made it like big, but it wasn't like the you know most original taste. Like it was.
Look, I'm just trying to find you some silver lining. I'm sorry.
No. This is done. There's absolutely none.
I've never understood first birthday parties. I've never understood that. The kid's not going to remember it. And if it's for the parents, no one wants to be there in the first. Why would you do a first birthday party?
I think if it's family makes sense. If it's like the entire family, but to invite like a third cousin twice removed, that's a little bit fucking
And subject everybody to a bunch of children. Yeah, no.
Oh my God, no. I barely want to see my own children.
My first birthday party apparently was insane. There was like 100 people there.
Wow.
But they bring the kids, and then for 2 hours, you celebrate the kid. It's like, oh, the kid is so cute. And all the other parents bring the kids. And then they take away the kids. Okay, and just the adults left, and they just eat and party and dance for like until 2 a.m.
But who takes the kids if all the parents are there?
And that's the beauty of, smaller towns and actual communities, the grandparents. Grandparents take them and everything is fine. I mean, my grandparents raised, 30% of who I am, grandparents.
Yeah.
I love that. Beautiful human beings. But yeah, the grandparents were to take them away. The grandparents were always there, not
that's
only
so nice.
Like, to be a helping hand, but also to like pass on some wisdom on, how do you do this? Because let's remember, up until literally 2 decades ago, nobody had access to good old Google. So holy shit, my kid is vomiting. Is that normal? You go ask grandma. She literally licks the puke and says, no, it is healthy, child.
Jesus Christ.
But that's how it was done. I genuinely plan on like today picking up my mother and putting in her in a spare room when I am a kid one day, possibly because I'm a lazy piece of shit. But
that's great. That's super healthy to have multiple generations of family to to rely on for advice and for support and stuff like that. Yeah, that's something that we don't really have, or at least a lot of people don't here in the States. That, yes, very envious of that.
No, I have a, what's it called? I have a relative who basically, I think I mentioned this before, I must have. I have a relative who basically, the child essentially has two sets of parents, and it's the grandparents and the actual parents, and they choose where they want to like sleep for the week. They're like, you know what, I want to be over there, right? Sometimes they'll, you know, like, basically they have like two households. It's very, very cute, but also the burden off of these younger relatives is, I can imagine.
That's
absolutely
crazy.
Fantastic.
Wow.
Well, I'm trying to, I was thinking of sharing with you guys a baby photo of me, which is a very early, birthday party of mine, but I can't for the fucking life of me find it.
No.
If you're willing to, if you're willing to be patient, I will find it.
Yeah. We were such barbarian, like so like rednecky, but now I thought we were rednecky when I was like 12, 13, 14 and looking at my first birthday party and how it was done, because it was over the top, everything over the top. But now I just realized, no, my parents were just very fun. Okay. We weren't referring to obviously the whole party. You know, a band playing and everything, but also my cake, my cake was a BMW car.
That rocks.
Oh my god, that's so cute.
Talk about a stereotype.
Also...
And I used to think that, like, when I was a teenager, I was like, man, they're cringe peasants, my parents. But then no, they're just fun. Okay, they're just fun. Now I go to first birthday parties, I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ, I want to castrate myself. So there you go. Love to my parents if you're listening.
Sorry, guys, no baby photos. I'm fighting for my life here. I'm looking.
That's okay. I've also been scrolling for my baby photos. I know I have at least a couple.
My God.
The audience is like, oh, this doesn't matter. We can't see them. I don't care. I'm sharing with my boys.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I want you to see how adorable I am.
In the meantime, fucking classic update that probably everybody hates at this point. So what happened with Volvo would be finished in March?
Today. You know, actually, I'm glad you asked. Today was the day that I put in my calendar because the guy said, all right, delivery date, March 19th. And here I am, March 19th, nothing. Nothing.
Dude.
I texted him again last Friday, like, hey, you still think you're going to have it done on Tuesday? Haven't heard back. This guy... He does really good work, but god damn, he's hard to pin down. He's it'll be done eventually. It'll be done eventually. Inshallah.
Inshallah. Where the fuck? Oh my god, I have graduation photos now at this point. What the hell? Sometimes it gets cold in the clinic, so what you do is you go and you take a large size glove. You know, these nitrile plastic gloves, and you put it on the tap of the of the faucet, and then you open it on the hottest water that it goes, and then you fill it up all the way, and then you close it, and then you basically hold hands with this water filter when it gets very cold. I have a photo of that.
That's so cute.
Dude, I found a fucking, like, Bengali mix cat bullshit on the street. I have photos of this, and I have photos of my
Tell me about the cats that I'm sure you've seen the video of the guy sitting on like a stoop with talking to a crowd of cats, and he's saying how it's Ramadan. And
yeah, he's like, oh, because now you have to be like Ramadan, so you guys have to fast now. But yeah. to the cats, he says you're gonna have to be vegetarians instead.
Yeah,
so their fast is from very silly thing.
That's
I'm gonna
so
give
cute.
It one last try. Hold on, I'm gonna give you guys one last try. These are thirst traps for Hugo. Scrolling past quickly.
Yeah, I can send one. I found one. I'm not a baby. Okay, there's me on the far right. That's my daddy holding me and my mama holding my little brother. And then on the
other...
Oh, my
God!
You look like such an Aryan child.
Yeah, we all
what
started
changed?
Out bleach blonde, yeah.
How did you become so Jewy?
We do.
Listeners, like the ultimate fucking Aryan child turned into a Syrian Jew now. Like, holy fucking shit.
Curly haired, olive skinned. Yeah. According to my dad, his like great grandmother or great grandmother fled some kind of persecution somewhere. And he thinks that she is from a Jewish family, but she never really. Said specifically.
Jesus Christ,
so,
I swear to God, in a previous life, I worked for the fucking Gestapo. I see one, I know one immediately, okay? I am kidding, listeners. Holy fucking
one of
shit.
My, One of my uncles is doing like a big family tree project. I'm going to have to go and see how far he's managed to get so far. he's got to find me.
Like for some reason, he goes back and there's like a few names that, you know, are crossed out. He's like, no, no, we don't talk about that part. We don't talk about that.
Yeah. I'll report back with my heritage shortly. I'll prove my pedigree.
I mean, you know, there's these agencies that can help find, you know, people in your family tree. They say that in Germany, those businesses are bankrupt.
Oh, my God.
Ain't no German want to know what Grandpa did. You know?
No.
All right, hello everybody, and welcome back to the program. Today we have another lovely episode in or installment in our All Presidents Are War Criminals. What would you call the series?
Series,
yeah. Before we start, as always, we would like to thank our lovely patrons, whom without their help and their lovely little kisses on my cheek, on Hugo's cheek, and especially JT's plump pink. Supple and whatever other keep going.
I'm almost
I'm so close. is beautiful cheeks. Without your guys' help, we wouldn't be able to do this. So thank you very much. Today we have a fun little series of more modern presidents, I guess you'd say. But let's start with arguably the least offensive. I dare say the least offensive U.S. president. Like out of the entire lot, which is very interesting, because you have quite a few to select from. Quite a few that, by the way, like, do most Americans know their presidents? I mean, more than like 15 presidents back.
No, right? Not more than 15. Certainly, like, not. You know, a handful of the older ones, but no.
Like the guy in like 1886, was that Lincoln? No, Lincoln was dead by then. No.
Bro, I couldn't tell you. You're asking an American.
All right, never mind. So my president today is Carter. He is, of course, the liberal favorite. And his name, again, something JT's going to have to explain to me. His name is James Earl Carter Jr. What is this junior shit about? This always that, like, it confused me as a younger,
so,
as you say.
Junior is like you want to give your kid your name, basically. Mm-hmm. So. If my daddy's name is John, and then I am also John, I would be John Jr. And if I name my son John, he would be John Chapman III, that sort of thing.
I see. Okay, interesting. Is that a running thing? Is that meant to keep, like, a particular family? Like, oh, every third son is named fucking Harold or something?
Everyone does it differently. Some people just do it because it's tradition at some point. Like, I am technically, well, I don't have the whole same name as my dad, so... Mm. I could go by Junior if I just wanted to be John Chapman Jr., but I don't know. I think it's a little goofy, personally.
Yeah, no, it is. It's definitely a little bit goofy. But, okay, very interesting. As far as I know, it's only an American thing.
I mean, we often, like, give names, not often, but now it's pretty rare, actually. But, you know, you give, you name your kid by your parent, like, so his grandpa or grandma.
Yeah, this we do as well.
But giving them your own name, kind of egomania, like, sounds wild. Like, holy shit, I'm sorry.
I found the baby photo.
But
share. Drop it in chat.
I found the baby photo, boys. Hold on.
Let me see.
You will not believe it. You will not believe your eyes. Something, something. Butterfly. That's a song, right?
Firefly. I'm remembering this. Owl City. Yeah.
Okay, hold on. Here you go. Rita, wee boys.
Oh, look at this little boy.
Oh, my God. He's eating. He is eating.
Little baseball shirt. Oh,
so cute.
But, yeah. What are you eating? Is that cake?
Apparently, I was eating a cake, and there's oranges in the foreground.
Yeah, there's some nice oranges.
Yeah, and you see the, what's it called? You see the, what the fuck is it called? You don't have that in the U.S., do you? In front of the windows, you have, like, this little square things. So basically,
Kelsey's family had that in Zimbabwe. I don't know what it's called. Like, the metal grate thing. Yeah.
Exactly right. You see it there as well. By the way, look at my skin tone. I am, like, 16 shades darker now. I don't know where this...
This is a white child. This would be acceptable. If this fella was to be bred by the previous Aryan child, we could have something decent exactly. that we can work here.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. CJT, we need to breed, all right?
Yeah, even Ugopnik couldn't tell you weren't white, yeah.
No. Yeah. Ugopnik, what is your Jew reader say? Saying? Yeah. What is your Jew reader?
Mengele grows inside of me. I would breed to these children. Oh, God. Okay, this is too much.
Oh. All right. Anyway,
very cute children. Too bad they turned into very ugly adults. But hey, you can't have anything. At least you had
can't
one period
them all.
Of life when you love the good, eh?
Exactly kidding, right.
Obviously, I'm kidding.
All right. So James Carter, or Jimmy Carter, he is currently age 99, I believe. He's almost a century old. He is both the oldest living former U.S. president and the longest lived U.S. president in history. So maybe him being the best of the bunch, which is still not a very good, is not a big, you know, like a star mark next to his name. But maybe that elongated his life a little bit. Anyways, he's also, by the way, the first U.S. president to be born in a hospital in Georgia of all.
Really?
Isn't that interesting to think about? Huh. So he was the first one. His mother was a nurse, and his dad owned basically a peanut farm. Now, what best to start off his liberal upbringing, particularly young, through the following quote. Although his father was staunchly pro-segregation, he allowed little Jimmy to befriend the black farmhand's children.
Aw, how liberal.
So exactly, yeah. So the progressiveness started quite early on. Anyways, being given the liberal head start he needed, of course, as an enterprising teenager, which, by the way, is a quote I've seen in several places.
Yeah.
Enterprising teenager. He was given his own acre of his father's farmland, by the way, where he grew, packaged, and sold peanuts, which, need I remind you, was the business of his dad's farm already, and also, these peanuts that he, quote-unquote, grew, packaged, and sold, all this was done by, the growth and the maintenance was done by his father's black farmhands.
Of course. But now they're friends, so.
Yeah, exactly right. He also entered into the land leech life early, where he rented out apparently a section of some tenant housing that he had purchased, again from proceeds of his father's land that was worked by black people.
Enterprising.
Yeah, exactly. Incredibly so. I'm just getting his liberal pedigree, clear from the get-go. Anyways, he graduated from Naval Academy in 1946. He got married and then turned into an agribusinessman, growing even more peanuts. Ooh, you know. By the way, all this talk of peanuts made me think of the American saying where if somebody were to pay you something and it's an insubstantial amount, Americans would say that's peanuts. Yeah. And I always wondered why. Like, peanuts are good. But, I mean, it's not substantial to pay, but...
It's not as good as money.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, out of all the ones you can pick, peanuts makes perfect sense, my brother. They're tiny. Okay, they're tiny. Peanuts.
So you'd ask for Brazil nuts instead?
By the way,
tangent. I fucking love Brazil nuts, but don't eat too many of them. They have so much selenium. Like four of them will give you, I think four of them will go over your daily need. And then if you eat more than that, which I can easily clear like half a fucking bag in one sitting, you can go into selenium poisoning. Don't. Be careful. Be careful with the Brazil nuts, but they're very good. But when offered, by the way, this is the test. You know when you test an oracle, right? When offered a Brazil nut, I will not refuse. Okay. So he got into the agribusiness, growing these peanuts, and then eventually he got his start through local elections. Very interestingly, apparently there's a lot of fraud in the local elections of Georgia, and he kind of spearheaded a thing to fight this fraud by getting himself in there, by basically discovering who was doing fraud, by not counting the ballots correctly and blah, 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 all this kind of nonsense, which is very interesting because you hear all the time, oh, America is the most fucking democratic, blah, 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 but from the very, you know, core unit, these local elections nobody gives a shit about, even there's the, you know, little, your vote counts for 0.8 while the other guy's vote counts for 1.2 in the machines. So yeah,
that's what I love about this country. We still want to be cowboys at heart. You're like, all right, partner, here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna take this box of your votes and I'm gonna burn it. Y'all got a problem with that? He's like, no, sir. Y'all go ahead and do that.
Meet me outside by high noon.
we'll count these votes.
All right. He began up these local elections, and he continued his proud tradition, very incredibly proud liberal tradition of, I pinky promise I support the civil rights movement, but I just won't say a word about it. The reason, by the way, that he gave personally is he was afraid of alienating his racist colleagues and his racist support base, which very, you know, of course, since you're trying to get elected, I guess. Anyways, in the gubernational election, which, by the way, yes, that is a word in English that I fucking hate, the gubernational. It sounds like you're intentionally mispronouncing.
Oh, the gubernatorial.
Okay, see? There we go. Okay. I'm the dumbass here.
It's a stupid word. No, it's not your fault.
I've only seen it in the context of American. I'm a well-read man. I've only seen this in the context of American elections. And I still don't know what the fuck. Just say state elections. Why do you have to say that? Okay. All right.
You want me to find out? Let me find the meaning real quick.
Sure, sure. Yes, why not?
Gubernatorial of or relating to a governor. Yeah, there you go.
I swear to God, this is... Anyways, so his goober election, Carter, and I quote, sought both the black vote and the votes of those who had supported prominent Alabama segregationist George Wallace. Now, you're probably scratching your head thinking, how do you seek both the black vote and the vote of a segregationist? I wonder. Well, basically...
Just ask Joe Biden.
Whoa, let's go. Exactly right. So... One week he'd basically meet with black civil rights figures, and the next he'd basically praise a segregationist and invite them to give speeches in Georgia, which again, basically like Biden. Anyways, and to quote, Carter's appeal to racism became more blatant over time, with his senior campaign aides handing out a photograph of his political opponents celebrating with black basketball players. That's supposed to dissuade people from voting for his opponents, because they
That's
see
so
him.
Stupid.
Yeah, I know, right? But yeah. Moving along, he was coming ahead in his goober election at 49%, but he wanted the further edge, so they went on the second round of elections. And in order to get this extra edge, he began criticizing black civil rights figures, like vocally or in public, which basically landed him at 60%. So there you go. The tried and tested method of, you know what, just be more racist, you'll get enough.
Yeah, masterful gambit. That's the only proven, like, scientifically proven way to get more votes in the United States.
Yeah,
like,
honestly. My God. Anyways, to his credit, once he was governor, he really did drop most of the racist talk, and he did start some decent policies. They include the usual, providing equal state aid to schools between wealthy and poor areas. He set up community centers for mentally disabled children, increased educational programs for convicts, for example, blah, blah, blah. Some good policies. He did some okay things. He did a lot of the, you know, oh, we need to cut the budget. We need to, like, stabilize our income, blah, blah. So he would reduce the size of different offices and administrative bureaus and stuff like that, which I know, like, to some is good, to some is bad, who cares? Moving on, though, he decided to run for president in 1976, or 1974, actually, but he ran proper in 1976, and he ran on an incredibly generic liberal populist platform of social aid, government reform, more education, less taxes on the poor, and some slightly raised taxes on the wealthier aspects of society, and, of course, the general appeal to a largely racist voting base, as always. Let me give you a quote that he was being interviewed. And by the way, this is not an out of hand. This was not a directed question. This was kind of almost an out of hand comment. If you look at the rest of it, at the very least, he said, "I have nothing against a community that's trying to maintain the ethnic purity of their neighborhoods." and he said this in particular, like when voicing opposition to government efforts to, and I quote, "inject black families into a white neighborhood just to create sort of integration."
Like it's a virus.
People really forget just how recent this era of the United States is, and to an extent still hasn't gone away. Any like. Has to a point. Okay, we're not gonna say that it doesn't, but at its core is still really there. Like, really recent. A lot of people have grandmas.
My dad was born like 10 years before this.
I bet if you somebody's probably done the numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised if more minorities die now to police violence than they did in the 70s. I would not be surprised.
Anyway. A lot of racists like say that is why apartheid in the United States was really good.
Oh yeah, exactly right. You know, we got to keep the
galaxy brain.
You know, I love the thing. It's like, oh, it's like laundry. You keep the white separate from the colored, but all the colored can get along just as fine with each other. What's so special about you, motherfucker? Anyways, we're the only ones with souls. Apparently, okay, sure.
Nice.
Wait, am I talking to Zionists? let's see. Anyway, so once he was president, he issued an executive order declaring unconditional amnesty for Vietnam War era draft evaders, which is a objectively very base thing to do, but also is a incredibly popular local policy, like national policy, because there are so many of these people. So that was pretty cool that he did that. Something less base that he did was he bailed out the Chrysler Corporation with the equivalent of almost $4 billion, which is the equivalent of $14 billion, I believe, in aid today. Which is a ridiculous amount of money. I believe $14 billion is enough to like get rid of all national debt, educational debt or something that, people have in the US. Or at least dent it for a good proportion. But no. The Chrysler Corporation needs that. He also signed into or helped sign and organize the Camp David Accords between Egypt and Israel at the time. He gave back the Panama Canal to Panama. He signed the SALT II nuclear arms reduction treaties with Brezhnev at the time. So there's a good... I'll summarize it in a little bit, but basically his policies were a mishmash of semi-good ideas of foreign policy. Common sense. Yeah, we need to kind of appeal to the ruling class within this country. We need to make them feel comfortable enough, and also a bunch of populist stuff. He towed the liberal line very well. Anyways, yeah. Some of the other stuff that he did was some fairly chill energy policy stuff, too. He put solar panels in the White House, and he was trying to, after the oil crisis of 1979, he was really trying to reduce the fossil fuel side of things. Of course, it was for geostrategic purposes at the time, but also there was a little environmental tinge to it, which was pretty neat. Moving on to less base things that he did also in his tenure, he signed the Airline Deregulation Act into law in 1978, which was basically an act to remove government control over fares, routes, market entry, particularly of new airlines from commercial aviation, stuff like that, which is...
So we can blame him for the gas chamber seating design they're coming up with now. Have you seen this?
Basically.
The two-tier thing where the dude in front of you's butt's right in your face.
Come on. Oh my God.
Gas chambered alligator. That took me a second.
He tried to make universal healthcare a thing, by the way, all the way back then.
Is American politics that boring to you, Hakeem?
Yeah, I'm sorry. But the reason I got so bored is because he tried to make universal healthcare a thing again, but he failed because the bill was defeated in the House. And this was in 1978, I believe. So again, guys, please, voting works, all right? We just gotta vote, please. I promise, just vote. I'm gonna vote.
I'm gonna vote.
But the meme here again is that this was 48 years ago. And it's the same fucking conversations about healthcare. For anybody who's telling you, oh, we just gotta push them a little bit left, oh, we gotta blah, 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 all this nonsense, this is what that gets you. After 50 fucking years, you still don't have universal healthcare. You guys are clowns. I'm not talking about you.
TikTok got banned within a week.
Yeah, exactly right.
If they wanted to do something, they'd do it.
Yeah, exactly right. Anyways, in December 1978, he announced the U.S.'s intention to recognize and establish full diplomatic relations with the PRC, so the People's Republic of China, starting from January 1st, 1979, while severing ties with Taiwan. And this included revoking some mutual defense treaty they had with Taiwan, which is arguably the most base thing that he did.
Yep.
But yeah, as I was mentioning before, his foreign policy was basically a mishmash of either let's not get involved, or let's support our Cold War allies, but not really directly, or let's work with apartheid, kind of. But try to be mean to them also a little bit, or sanctions. It's a very sensible liberal approach, I guess, which is still batshit crazy, but at the very least it's better than what was going to come after him, which was Reagan, for those unaware. Anyways, to TLDR this, he was marginally better than the usual, but for American standards even slight shifts count for quite a bit, and that's why he's kind of viewed more, I guess, reasonably, especially after these many decades after he was president. Following the invitation of the Afghani government of Soviet troops to, come in and help them with their local insurgency problem, the U.S. immediately started covert CIA missions and actions to assist the Mujahideen with weapons and funding and whatnot. He decided to start sanctioning the USSR. He boycotted the Summer Olympics at the time, a bunch of other, tantrum nonsense stuff. Carter, at the end, to kind of make up for the more cringe aspects of the things that he did, he ended support, U.S. support for the Somoza dictatorship or Somoza regime in Nicaragua. He cut back and then eventually, I believe, also terminated aid to Pinochet in Chile. He cut back or restricted aid to Ernesto Gisel in Brazil, in Jorge Rafael Videla in Argentina. So all these fascist dictators that previous regimes have propped up, his CIA kept propping up, but he decided to cut funding to them. So basically, he just tightened their belts, I guess. But yeah, the end of his presidency was mired by inflation and cost of living issues, the fuel prices rising as a result of the 1979 oil crisis, generally slowed economic growth. This happened mostly outside of his control. These were international things that were going on, of course. His post-presidency period, I believe, is the least problematic part of his life, because he was, for example, to my knowledge, I believe he was the only U.S. president to have criticized Israel publicly. and didn't, like, you know, preface it with a whole bunch of, yo, no, no, I worship at the altar of Israel. But, you know, like, yeah, yeah, he specifically criticized them, called them apartheid regime, based stuff. He did also some diplomacy work between the U.S. and the DPRK. He opposed the Iraq war, so very, very cool of him. He criticized drone strikes by Obama. He criticized the fact that Guantanamo Bay was still open. I don't know why he didn't close it when he was president. Yeah. But, you know, I guess they always become more, you know, I guess decent. Yeah, mm-hmm. when they're out. He criticized the many U.S. surveillance programs of their population, amongst many other things. Something that's a bit weird, which I want to get your perspective on, the Russian interference in the American election stuff, which quote-unquote brought Trump to power, that nonsense, he believes that bullshit. Didn't they look into this and found fucking nothing?
Yeah, I don't know why he would go to bat for that particularly. Mm. I mean, it's still something that the liberals will trot out. They're still like, oh, he's a Russian asset. They're going to do the same thing this time, but... I don't know why he would choose to pick that thing. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
But anyway, so he has voiced this perspective, which is whatever, I guess. Regardless, he was vocal about voting for Bernie Sanders, I believe, in the previous, no, the 2016 election, was it, when Bernie Sanders was, right? Yeah. And he was vocal about that also, which is cool, I guess. But generally, the best part of his post-presidency period is his criticism of Israel. As mentioned, he called it an apartheid state before liberals found the term in vogue. And he specifically repeatedly blamed Israel's lack of willingness or the stubbornness as the primary obstacle to anything happening, to anything positive happening in the region. He always blames specifically them, which is a very mature perspective for us, particularly for an American president. Yeah,
very good for a U.S. president.
For a man, that grew up in the period he grew up in, man that is a product of the U.S. Liberal ideological dominance, let's call it, and a man who was given so much power and control over the world's most fucked up imperial project, arguably...
Not bad,
right? Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I would drink some tea, beer with him, you know? Like, okay. I would be able to live with calling this person an acquaintance compared to pretty much.
Certainly, maybe, certainly compared to the next two presidents we're going to talk about.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, Lord.
What, you're talking, but what about the tan suit? Oh, this only,
he's so representable.
All right. Anyways, to complete the liberal tidbit, I'm going to give you a nice little quote. In 2019, Trump called Carter and expressed concern that China was getting ahead of the U.S. Carter agreed, saying that China's strength came from its lack of involvement in armed conflict, calling the U.S. the most warlike nation in the history of the world.
Which is such basic analysis. It's like, duh. But that coming from a president, again, a man who grew up in what he grew up in and who was molded by his profession and his upbringing. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Pretty, nice.
But the subtext of this, which is a little bit irritating, maybe I'm reading too much into it, is the U.S. shouldn't stop because it's just blatantly wrong on a fundamental level. But no, it's no longer worth the squeeze, okay? Basically, it's a general vibe I'm getting. But towards the end, basically, he wasn't actually well-meaning liberal and about as much as you can ask for in the rotten system that is American politics.
Yeah.
So that's Carter. There you go. This is the best the United States has offered.
I think so, honestly. Like, not... You could say he was bad in the sense that he stood for the U.S. empire, and that is bad by default. But, like, as an individual goes, he's probably the least gross of any U.S. president. Mm.
Exactly right.
So, yes, all your presidents are war criminals, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. With a tiny little asterisk.
Yeah. I mean... it was great that we covered him because now we can use it as an excuse. Oh, the show isn't just like America bashing, okay? There, we said one is like kind of okay. So we can point at it. It's like when racists say they have a black friend. We have like a president we like. Oh, no. You had like that one guy. That one guy. Yeah, that one. Yeah, kind of nice.
Yeah, Carter had a black friend. Yeah, who worked on his plantation.
Oh, God. Oh, Lord. Okay, moving on from what we kind of said is a liberal darling of the United States electoral system. To my absolutely least favorite president, arguably, in American history. The literal Shaitan, the founder of the drug war, of the 500,000 tons bomb dropper on Cambodia, the guy who could have stopped the Vietnam War immediately but prolonged it, and many, many, many other things. The guy who tried to create basically his own SS division inside of the U.S., our boy Richard Nixon. Now, this great Shaitan was born on January 9th, 1913 in California. Nixon grew up in a family of modest means. His father, Frank Nixon, worked as a lemon farmer and later owned a grocery store, while his mother, Hannah Nixon, was a homemaker and devout Quaker. I had to Google later what Quaker is, just, you know. Subcategory of Christianity, what in the rest of the world would just call a sect, but you guys have like 700 denominations, so God bless you to you. And Nixon was the second of five children, but tragically two of his brothers died in childhood, leaving a lasting impact on him. Nixon excelled academically, and after graduating from high school in 1930, he enrolled in Whittier College, a small Quaker institution near his hometown. He graduated in 34 with a degree in history and pursued a career in law by enrolling at the prestigious Duke University. He graduated near the top of his class in 37 and returned to California to practice law. Nixon's early legal career was interrupted by a little thing called, you know, just World War II, during which he served in the U.S. Navy as a lieutenant commander in the Pacific Theater. He was stationed in the South Pacific, which most biographies would leave at that, letting you imagine our guy manning cannons, blowing up suicide Japanese planes, but no. He was in logistics the whole time. Apparently, he did pretty well and was awarded a bunch of times, which would later be used in his campaign to call on him as a decorated war veteran, which, I mean, okay, he was, not to undermine that period of his life, but people probably interpreted that as him being, I don't know, Rambo Terminator 300 in the pre-Google era. Something very commonly nowadays they do. I think Nikki Haley like constantly refers to her like crying about how her husband is serving the country, and he's in the fucking Coast Guard or whatever, sitting in a base like inside of the United States. You know, he's sacrificing so much! Dude basically has a whole, like office. But just pinpointing this, that's been used for a very long time, but was used with Nixon's later campaign by just, you know, it's not lying, it's not giving you the full story. Anyways, after the war, Nixon returned to California and resumed his legal career, but he soon entered Politica. In 1946, he ran for Congress as a Republican candidate, and his political story began. Now, it's 1945. Frustrated Republicans in California's 12th congressional district formed a so-called Committee of 100. That was really an era of a lot of committees, as we will soon find out. They wanted to find a consensus candidate to challenge Democratic Representative Jerry Voorhees. They turned to Richard Nixon, a family friend and Whittier College trustee who had just returned from serving in the Navy. It was perfect. They knew him from college, war veteran, absolutely phenomenal. Nixon, after an enthusiastic response, flew to California and began an intensive campaign against Voorhees. By 1946, he had won the election with 65K votes to Voorhees's 49, making that the start of his very long and fucking horrendous political career. Voorhees, why didn't you win, you piece of fucking shit? Okay, literally with a like alternate universe, Voorhees won and we didn't have this guy. As a congressman, Nixon supported the Taft-Hartley Act, starting his whole image of an ardent, insane, reactionary anti-communist. For those who don't know, the act was a federal law that monitors the activities and power of labor unions, a meme you can throw at people who say you couldn't say anything against the system in the USSR because, well, you couldn't do that either in the parallel era of the United States. Among the practices prohibited by the Taft-Hartley Act are, you know, just classic stuff like you're forbidden from doing jurisdictional strikes, wildcat strikes, solidarity strikes, political strikes. You can't do secondary boycotts. You can't do mass picketing. You can't close shops. And you can't do monetary donations by unions to federal political campaigns. The amendments also allowed states to enact right-to-work laws, which now we are very familiar with, banning union-owned or ran shops. Finally, the law required union officers to sign non-communist affidavits with the government. Nixon also became a member of the House, our favorite, my favorite, House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, co-sponsoring the Mundt-Nixon Bill in May 1948. It had its fucking name on it, to combat internal communist subversion. Dude, we literally live in their heads. Like, we live in their heads. Like, dude, there was like 700... like billion-dollar funded institutions in the United States to combat what they keep telling us is an ideology that can't work and that you know, nobody really wants, et cetera, et cetera. The same House Committee on Un-American Activities, commonly known as the House Un-American Activities Committee, was established by, I think, 1938 by the United States House of Representatives. Its primary purpose was to investigate allegations of disloyalty and subversive activities, particularly those with suspected communist affiliations among private citizens, public employees, and organizations. Initially formed as a temporary committee, it became a permanent standing by 1945. In 69, it was renamed the House Committee on Internal Security until its thankful abolition in 1975, when its responsibilities were transferred to the House Judiciary Committee. Again, please throw this at anyone who implies simplistic notions of freedom of political opinion in that era of the United States. These are systematic policies, okay, with fucking committees willing to annihilate your life if you are even suspected of harboring anti-capitalist ideas. And our boy Nixon was so fucking there for it. Nixon gained national attention in August 1948 for his role in the Alger Hiss communist Soviet spy case. Despite doubts from many, Nixon persisted in investigating Whitaker Chambers' allegation against Hiss, leading to Hiss' conviction for perjury in 1950. Nixon's success in the case, coupled with his re-election in 1948, solidified his reputation as a rising political figure. But based on what we heard by now, he built 100%, I am not undermining it, that's all he did, 100% of his political career on being an anti-communist. That was the whole pitch. Nixon ran literally just on that, anti-communist, anti-communist, anti-communist. And just the state, the insane state, the culture in that country was at that point and would increase in the coming decade was so wild that that could very easily get you elected.
Yeah.
While in contrast, absolutely any correlation with the evil C word would get you barred from absolutely anything. Later, Nixon ran for U.S. State Senate, with the Korean War being the major topic of the day, again, fighting communists. Nixon focused on highlighting his opponent's liberal voting record, even distributing a so-called pink sheet, Google that if you don't know what it is, suggesting her political views were aligned with a reputed communist. Nixon won the election by a significant margin, and during the campaign, he was dubbed Tricky Dick for his tactics. Hence, Tricky Dick was born. I wish it was under funnier circumstance so I could, you know, fuck around with Tricky Dick, because that's a fucking great nickname, let's be honest, for a guy named Dick. But no, unfortunately, it's wrapped in being the definition of a class traitor, because as we've heard, he pretty much comes from almost working class background. As a senator, wait for your surprise, Nixon took a prominent stance against global communism, frequently speaking out against it and maintaining friendly relations with anti-communist figures like Senator Joseph McCarthy, you know, the American Gestapo guy, basically. In 1952, General Eisenhower nominated Nixon as his running mate for the presidential election. The Republican ticket won the election, and Nixon assumed a more active role as vice president than his predecessors, attending and sometimes chairing cabinet and National Security Council meetings. Eisenhower and Nixon were also later re-elected in 56. By 59, Nixon engaged in the famous kitchen debate with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev during a visit to the American National Exhibition in Moscow. Basically, the Soviets did a conference in the U.S. and the Americans did one in Moscow, trying to, like, bridge some differences, yada, yada. In one of the rooms in the conference was a depicted standard American home with all, like, the fancy appliances and so on, where Nikita Khrushchev and Nixon engaged in the so-called, as I said, kitchen debate, which was apparently streamed both in the U.S. in English and the Soviet Union in Russian afterwards. The most interesting part of the debate was, I mean, it wasn't a debate, they're just talking, but let's call it a debate. The most interesting part of it was when Khrushchev, acknowledging the far more advanced level of tech regular Americans have access to, by saying, this is what America is capable of. Wait, this is what America is capable of. And how long has she existed? 300 years, 150 years of independence. And this is her level. We haven't quite reached 42 years. And in another 7-8, we'll be at the level of America, and after that, we'll go further. Moving on, Nixon ran against and lost to Kennedy in the 1960 presidential election by only a 0.2 margin. He spent the next 8 years building up a law firm, traveling Europe, writing best-selling books, and just living La Vida Loca. But, unfortunately for the rest of the world, in 1968, he ran again. Nixon believed that the Democrats' division over the Vietnam War could give the Republicans a strong chance of winning the election, expecting a close contest similar to 1960. Here he was really impressed by, inspired by his friend Kissinger, who you can roll back and listen to that episode if you want to know more details about that aspect. The primary election season of 1968 was marked by significant turmoil, coinciding with the Tet Offensive and President Johnson's, I love that name, withdrawal from the race after a disappointing showing in the New Hampshire primary. The Democratic side saw the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, while Nixon faced competition from figures like George Romney, Nelson Rockefeller, and Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination. In the general election, after he had won, Nixon faced Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who was nominated amidst violent protests. Nixon positioned himself basically as a symbol of stability during a period of national unrest, appealing to the silent majority of socially conservative Americans who opposed counterculture and the anti-war movement, just like Hakeem said earlier in the coverage of Carter. Dude, they like American elections last 100 years at least, just rerunning on basically the same points over and over and over again. This Nixon's campaign was no different. Agnew also emerged as a vocal critic of these groups, bolstering Nixon's support among the right-wing electorate. Nixon's television advertising campaign emphasized his promises of restoring law and order, maintaining nuclear superiority, and achieving peace with honor in Vietnam, although he offered few specifics on his plans for ending the war. This is extremely similar to Trump's current campaign, and it's probably going to work really well. Yeah. Amidst rumors of a potential October surprise by the Johnson administration to aid Humphrey's campaign, Nixon ultimately secured victory in the general. He became the first non-incumbent vice president to be elected president, pledging to unify the divided nation in his victory speech. His career as president is filled with hundreds of different scandals, policies of horror, and anti-communist lunacy that would probably take 5 episodes to cover in detail. So let me give you a few of my favorites. And by favorites, I mean least favorite, but you get my point. Starting with the Cambodian genocide orchestrated by the Khmer Rouge regime from 1965 to 1979, resulting in the deaths of approximately 1.7 million people. The U.S., through extensive bombing campaigns conducted in Cambodia, not only destabilized the nation, but also contributed to the emergence of the Khmer Rouge. Despite being aware of the atrocities committed by them, Nixon supported the group as a strategic counterbalance to North Vietnam during the Vietnam War era. This support persisted even after the Khmer Rouge was ousted from power, impeding efforts to bring justice to the victims of the genocide. Quote by Nixon, 1970, to Kissinger: "They have got to go in there, and I mean really go in. I don't want the gunships, I want the helicopter ships. I want everything they can fly to go in there and crack the hell out of them. There is no limitation on mileage, and there is no limitation on budget. Is that clear? Over 500,000 tons of explosives were dropped on Cambodia. That's more than the entirety of what the U.S. dropped in the Pacific theater of World War II. How many people the U.S. killed or injured will most likely never be known. But we're talking hundreds of thousands, of course. When it comes to the Khmer Rouge, let's look at a 1973 intelligence information cable from the CIA's Directorate of Operations. Khmer Rouge cadre have begun an intensified campaign among ethnic Cambodian residents in an effort to recruit young men and women for military organizations. They are using damage caused by B-52 strikes as the main theme of their propaganda," end quote. U.S.-backed coup that removed the previous leader of Cambodia from power in 1970 was another factor that dramatically strengthened the KR insurgency. Direct U.S. complicity in the coup remains, quote-unquote, unproven, but as William Blum documents in his book Killing Hope that everybody should read, there is enough evidence to warrant the possibility. In November 1975, 7 months after KR forces seized control of the country from the far-right wing installed government that Henry Kissinger, together with our boy, pretty much installed, Henry said to Thailand's foreign minister that he, quote, should tell the KR, the Khmer Rouge, that we bear no hostility towards them. We would like them to be independent as a counterweight to North Vietnam. Kissinger added that he, quote, should also tell the Cambodians that we will be friends with them. They are murderous thugs, but we won't let that stand in our way. We are prepared to improve relations with them, end quote. The classic collaboration with monsters against a common enemy trope. They also later helped China support Khmer guerrillas against the Vietnamese government, which kicked out the Pol Pot animals and stopped the genocide. Already pretty bad, but no, let's continue. Next, we have the good old drug war. Yes, my boy, Nixon is who you get to thank for that fucking classic. A system handcrafted not to safeguard the American people from drugs, but to suppress dissent, particularly from the anti-war and black rights movements of the 1970s. Former Nixon policy advisor John Ehrlichman confessed that the campaign aimed to associate certain groups with drugs, enabling their persecution and silencing through arrests, raids, and media vilification. This strategy mirrored the racist rhetoric of figures like Henry Anslinger, who demonized marijuana to target minority communities. The drug war intensified after the civil unrests of the late 1960s, with legislation like the 1968 Omnibus Crime Control Act used to quash dissent. The war on drugs perpetuates racial inequality, entrapping individuals in a cycle of incarceration while stripping them of their rights. Marijuana in particular became very emblematic at the time of anti-authoritarian sentiment, linking drug use with opposition to the Vietnam War. Despite its devastating consequences in terms of lives lost and resources wasted, the drug war persists, bringing tanks to streets and overflowing the prison system with the poor. Nixon's brainchild lives to this day, an impressively fucked up self-replicating mechanism for crushing the most disenfranchised. Next, we have what got him eventually fired from the highest seat in office, Watergate. Our boy came up with a brilliant idea. What if the party itself had a special unit, something like an ideologically pure FBI, to do whatever the party leadership tells them needs to be done? These activities encompassed a range of underhanded tactics, including the wiretapping of political opponents' offices and the intimidation of activist groups and figures. The scandal first gained widespread attention when 5 individuals were apprehended while attempting to unironically break into the Democratic Party headquarters at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C., hence the name, Watergate. The subsequent investigation into the break-in revealed a deeper layers of corruption within the Nixon administration, and despite initial attempts to downplay the significance of the incident, a series of revelations exposed the involvement of the Committee to Re-elect President Nixon, CRP, very original names, and later the White House itself in efforts to undermine the Democratic Party. As the scandal unfolded, key figures within the administration, including White House counsel John Dean, faced legal repercussions, and a total of 48 officials were convicted of various offenses. The revelation that President Nixon had installed a secret taping system in the motherfucking Oval Office added another dimension to the controversy. Despite Nixon's refusal to release the tapes, citing executive privilege, the House Judiciary Committee initiated impeachment proceedings against him in May of 1974. The hearings, broadcast on major television networks, captivated the nation, and public opinion turned against Nixon as more damning evidence emerged. Amid mounting pressure and diminishing support, Nixon faced the revelation of a critical tape known as the Smoking Gun tape, which implicated him in the cover-up of the Watergate burglaries. Faced with near-certain impeachment and lacking the necessary backing in Congress, Nixon announced his resignation from the presidency on August 8, 1974, becoming the first U.S. president to embarrassingly do so. The Watergate scandal left an undeniable mark on American politics, underscoring the importance of so-called accountability, transparency, and the rule of law. The man who made his whole career about screaming about authoritarians got caught trying to make the conservative version of the Stasi or whatever. A pathetic career politician whose want for power utilized anti-communist American frenzy to establish himself and his arguably even worse buddy, Henry Kissinger, over not much else but a mountain of corpses. He also got rid of the gold standard, by the way, but that's a story for another time. Now, let's leave this shitbag in the dustbin of history.
Where he deserves to be.
Rip, big tricky dick. Rip.
Tricky dick. Hey, tricky dick. Dude, like, legendary piece of shit. Like, legendary piece of shit. Like, it's almost as if he did it intentionally, which, after really digging deep, I mean, I've read about him plenty in the past, but now for this episode, I really dig deep. Arguably wanted to, but, like, just be horrific. Like, I think, like, that was intention behind.
He was just an asshole. He was just, like, he seems like your typical pseudo-alcoholic grandpa. Just a all-around piece of shit.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the lives of hundreds of thousands do not matter if I get to get reelected.
Yeah.
And sometimes not even to get reelected, but to get a few more claps from my potential voting.
Uh-huh.
Like, he was really milking being a professional career politician to the core. Lives do not matter. Conflicts do not matter. Stability in foreign nations does not matter. Stability at home doesn't even matter. Because, again, he ran on the constant, you know, we need to preserve the American way of life. The communists are bad because authoritarian, right? That was the main pitch that he always put forward. And then we see in his later life that he genuinely wanted to just be reelected forever by creating these, you know, side sub-governmental or over-governmental systems which would allow the Republican Party to remain in power and him as the head of the Republican Party, which he was at that point, to also remain in power. So not only a horrendous career politician, but also an immense, immense hypocrite, which almost always comes hand in hand.
Ain't that just the way? Well, thank you for that lovely rundown on everybody's.
Yeah, speaking of a hypocrite,
piece of shit. Yeah, let's move on to a Democrat who is also a big old hypocrite. We're going to talk about Obama, everybody's favorite reformed Marxist and Nobel Prize recipient. While we may never have found out what his last name is, we do have some interesting data regarding the playful mischief he got up to as president of the United States. But before we get into the facts, let's take a quick look at how the liberals see Obama, because it's very different from the reality. According to the people who have ironed every wrinkle out of their brains, Obama was a champion of peace, progress, and basic human decency. Even white suburbanites marveled at how well-spoken this urban fellow was. Where W was a... it's genuinely true. The number of times I've heard, like, from scared white people in the suburbs. Oh, but he's, you know, I didn't expect it, but he's just so well spoken. He's so articulate. I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, just say what you want to say.
Yeah.
But anyway, where W was a bumbling goof, Obama was seen as a well-meaning guy who, you know, he didn't want to kill people, but it just kind of happened sometimes because it was out of his control. This man was so beloved by the liberal intelligentsia that in 2009, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his, quote, vision and work for a world without nuclear weapons. And it sounds like a pretty stand-up guy, right? Well, with the benefit of hindsight, even some liberals, though admittedly not all that many, are starting to come around on the fact that Obama was just as much a war criminal as any other U.S. president. And in some cases, he was uniquely destructive. Obama is known for expanding the drone program, which we'll get to in a sec. But it's worth noting that much of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is directly his fault as well. Obama staunchly backed the Saudi coalition, which was clearly butchering Yemeni civilians. This was well known. And not only with words, the Obama administration sent material support to the coalition, including logistical assistance, and the sale of $1.29 billion worth of smart bombs. I'll read a short excerpt from Human Rights Watch back in 2015. Quote, "The war, and particularly the numerous coalition airstrikes, has taken a terrible toll on civilians. As of late September, the UN had documented that the war had killed 2,355 civilians and wounded 4,862, the majority in coalition airstrikes. In the nearly two dozen strikes that we have investigated on the ground, we collected the names of more than 300 civilians who died, many of them children. And the civilian deaths continue. In the last few weeks, local authorities and activists in Yemen have reported that coalition aircraft bombed two wedding parties, killing dozens of civilians. While a proper investigation is needed to establish the facts, our research shows that many coalition airstrikes that have killed civilians violated the laws of war." End quote. So Obama willingly contributed to what was and remains one of the worst humanitarian crises in modern history. All told, 21 million Yemenis were left in desperate need of humanitarian aid, and all they got was the world's biggest bully handing wads of cash to the people butchering them, and the Western media completely ignoring the crisis. The massacre in Yemen should bring to mind another ongoing crime, the genocide in Gaza. Both happened not thanks to the U.S. turning a blind eye, but with the explicit and material support of the United States. One under Obama, one under Biden. Both liberal champions of peace, decency, and progress, and both unapologetic war criminals. But now let's talk about the drone program, what Obama is best known for these days. Obama approved more drone strikes in his first year in office than Bush did in his entire presidency. During Obama's presidency, he approved 563 drone strikes that killed at least 3,797 people. Many of those strikes were secret, only made public later, including at least 54 in Pakistan during his first year in office. One of those strikes has become infamous, a CIA-led drone strike at a funeral that killed at least 41 innocent Pakistanis. The following year, Obama would approve 128 CIA drone strikes in Pakistan, killing at least another 89 civilians. In 2010 and 2011, Obama extended the drone program into Somalia and Yemen. Supposedly targeting al-Qaeda, the first strike in Yemen killed 55 people, including 21 children, 10 of whom were under the age of 5. Also among them were 5 pregnant women. Then there was Afghanistan. In 2014, as the U.S. started withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, Obama took the opportunity to drastically increase air power in the region. In 2016, the U.S. dropped over 26,000 bombs across 7 different countries. And when it came time to tally his score at the end of the Obama presidency, he had killed an average of 582 civilians every single year of his 2 terms. Now, a lot of you probably already knew about the drone strikes, but I bet you haven't heard about the double tap policy. The Obama regime was so intent on killing civilians that after they hit a drone target, they waited for first responders to show up, and then they hit the target again, killing medical personnel and any civilians who came to tend to the wounded. If there ever comes a time when the U.S. ceases to exist as it does today and there's an opportunity to try U.S. presidents for their crimes, Obama's case will be open and shut. The Geneva Convention explicitly provides protection for the wounded, as well as medical personnel and transports. The Rome Statute states that, quote, intentionally directing attacks against personnel, installations, material, units, or vehicles involved in a humanitarian assistance or peacekeeping mission in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations is a war crime. It says the same for conducting attacks that will knowingly endanger civilians. So while Obama is seen as a liberal darling and a champion of decency and humanity, it's important to recognize that this guy not only played the game of imperialism, he found entirely new speedrun strats to make sure he had the high score. And this is only one aspect of Obama's crimes. You could write an entire book on this guy and the evil he committed. But we don't want this episode to go too long, so maybe we'll do another episode down the line specifically on Obamna. But for now, we'll leave it there. All right, well, there you go. 3 lovely U.S. presidents. One you might be able to sit down and have a beer and a handful of peanuts with. One that'll probably call you a racial slur, regardless of what color you are. And one that's likely to bomb your house. So there you go. You pick your favorite. Let us know in the comments who your favorite
will be. You know how little that narrows it down.
Yeah. Honestly. All right. Well, there you go, friends. Hope you enjoyed the episode. We're off to go prep for the next one. And Obama, yeah. Oh, we didn't even mention that Barack Hussein Obama. That's a little sus. All right. With all that being said, this has been the Deprogram. I'm JT.
All right, Gabe.
I'm Yugopnik, and he's really presentable, Barack Hussein.